Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to today's Unbelievable show with myself, Justin Brierley. A very special one today, bringing you episode 2 of our current Big Conversation Season 3. On radio, podcast and video, it's all about bringing the biggest thinkers together to discuss the biggest questions of life, faith, science and philosophy. And today we're talking about artificial intelligence and the search for immortality with two very eminent guests, Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard. And I shall introduce them both shortly. You can find out more about The Big Conversation and all our bonus content at its own special website, thebigconversation.show. And our very exciting news about a live streamed edition of episode 3 to announce in just a moment's time. But only about 3 weeks away now, you can book your place at Unbelievable The Conference 2021. Find it at unbelievable.live. So many great speakers and great topics as we show you how to tell the greatest story ever told, especially in a post-COVID world. Recently announced our conference sponsors for that conference, Harvester Ministries. So thanks so much to them for supporting the conference this year. Again, if you want to get yourself booked in, it's unbelievable.live. Now, one of our special guest speakers at the conference, of course, is N.T. Wright, Tom Wright. And we've some very exciting news about the third episode of this Big Conversation season, because as a curtain raiser to that conference on Thursday, the 13th of May, Tom will be in a live stream dialogue with none other than Douglas Murray, the well-known journalist and social commentator who has described himself on this very show as a Christian atheist. I'm really excited about bringing these two together, especially as it's going to be a live stream conversation on our YouTube channel and Facebook page. So you can find out more about that, how to make sure you're in the right place at the right time by going to thebigconversation.show. If you get yourself subscribed to the newsletter, you'll get a reminder on the day with the link for the conversation. And at the end of today's show, I'll be talking to Tom Wright himself about the forthcoming conference, Saturday the 15th of May, and that conversation with Douglas Murray a couple of days earlier on the 13th of May. They'll be talking about identity, myth, and miracles. How do we live in a post-Christian world? Again, details at thebigconversation.show. Okay, time to get technological with my guests for this week's special show. And by the way, once again, we'd love to know your thoughts on today's show. Do you agree more with Nick or Roz? We've got a survey from today's show, very quick and multi-choice. It's with the info with today's episode of the programme. Love you to fill it in and hear your response. Well, hello and welcome to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, brought to you in partnership with the John Templeton Foundation. And today we're talking about God, artificial intelligence and the future of humanity, and asking, is technology the key to immortality? This season is, of course, being recorded for obvious reasons remotely, but that does allow us to bring together some really interesting people from all over the globe. And joining me today are Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard. Nick Bostrom is the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford and a leading voice in AI and technology. Nick's the author of Superintelligence, which warned of the possible dangers that the rapid development of artificial intelligence may pose globally. Rosalind Picard is director of Effective Computing at MIT, harnessing the power of AI to develop things like wearable technology, machine learning that predicts and responds to human emotion and well-being, helping people with autism, with epilepsy, depression, and many other physiological conditions. So today, with Nick and Roz, we're going to be looking at the future of AI and asking big questions like the ethics of AI. Could machines become conscious one day? Might we all be uploaded to some digital heaven? And what if we're all living in a universe simulated by godlike alien technology? Just a few of the little questions in life. So I'm really looking forward to this program. So good to have you with me, Nick and Roz. Tell me, first of all, we'll start with you, Nick. You head up the Future of Humanity Institute. It sounds like something from a sci-fi film or something. Are you basically there to sort of predict doomsday, you know, technological scenarios and just make sure they're averted? What is it you do at the Institute?
Yeah, especially the latter. Like, if I could either predict or prevent, I would choose to prevent. Well, we are a interdisciplinary research group. We have computer scientists, mathematicians, philosophers, physicists, trying to get the clearer understanding of some of the really big picture questions regarding the future prospects for intelligent life, threats to the survival of the human species, and in particular the levers, like where are the opportunities where by some modest effort now we might improve the expected value of the long-term future.
And I mean, does that just involve a lot of sort of sitting around and thinking through issues? I mean, obviously, you have to keep abreast of all the latest developments, I suppose, in technology doing that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of our work is focused more on the kind of underlying questions rather than, you know, what's next year's iPhone going to be like. We're these kind of ripples on the great pond are not really our focus, but sometimes the most important questions are the ones that get the least attention. So, for example, if we continue to make impressive progress in machine intelligence, what happens down the line when AI finally succeed at not just automating specific tasks, but providing the same general kind of intelligence and problem solving that have made us humans unique on this planet? And other more ways that the human condition could change in some more fundamental way.
It's very much big picture stuff, obviously. I know you don't have any personal religious beliefs, Nick, but does the issue of God ever come up in your research, questions around religion and that kind of thing?
Well, it comes up in my own thinking, not so much in the specific research products we are pursuing. And I can't speak for all of my colleagues there. But at some point, I think, if you zoom out enough and start to think about really what is the human condition all about and what might it lead to, you do start to butt up against theological concerns. Unfortunately, that's also the point where my competence kind of runs out to some extent. So,
We'll be testing your competence a little bit on the program today, Nick, because I would love to open up some of those metaphysical questions that the AI pose around consciousness, ethics, and even the God question at some level. But we'll start obviously by talking about AI and what some of the possibilities and challenges are. Before we do that, Roz, welcome to the show as well. Now, you've pioneered this field of effective computing for over two decades, I think. Tell us firstly what it is and what sort of things you've been developing in the process.
Yeah, effective computing is computing that relates to, arises from, or deliberately influences emotion. The original idea was that computers were driving us nuts. They were so stupid and frustrating. And the kind of intelligence we wanted to build for the future AI was not just playing games like chess or Go, or using language or solving math, but was not being annoying, right? A computer or a robot that you would actually want to have around, and that if you were frustrated or pleased, it would see that, use that as feedback, and learn to do better. and have skills for how to manage emotion, not just recognizing them, but knowing how to help us manage our emotions in respectful ways, always with deference for people's feelings, not sensing things if we don't want them, and so forth. So I saw it as a hierarchy out of wanting to respect people's feelings, and that these were skills that we could teach computers how to do better at.
And what has that resulted in terms of some of the practical applications that you've been able to engineer in the process?
We have been surprised. In the beginning, the idea, I think, was very much about, like, what would a robot do? What would a software agent do in interacting with a person to be intelligent? And what might happen deep inside a machine that most people don't see that might be like how the human brain works that might enable it to think more intelligently, not that computers think like we do, but to have processes that give it better flexibility and generalizability and things like that. We have actually found that there are a lot more applications than that, and many applications have to do with human health. For example, we learned that the fundamental mechanisms inside us when we're having feelings communicate with pretty much every organ in the body. And when you look at the messages they carry, they change when people are healthy or sick. And by paying attention to these unseen aspects of our emotion system, we could help people have better health. So we have been working on a lot of cool things that have come out of that. Like, we accidentally developed a seizure detector. Actually, it became the focus of Ming Zerpo's PhD thesis and the focus of a spin-out company, Empatica, that's now an FDA-cleared device that I'm wearing here called Embrace. But we've followed the data where it goes, and wherever we can, looked to see how if we can steer it to help make lives better.
Well, in that sense, it sounds very much like you're obviously harnessing technology for a wonderful end, even if there may be potential pitfalls in other parts of, you know, the AI story. Before we start talking about that, I'm fascinated a little bit about your own faith journey, because I think you had an adult conversion to Christianity yourself, Roz. So how does someone who's evidently intelligent, scientifically minded end up believing in God?
There's some longer versions of this people can read if they go to places like Christianity Today or other talks. But the short version is I was an atheist and a skeptic and a very proud one. And when I was challenged to read the best-selling book of all time, the one that is so best-selling they leave it off the bestseller list because it dwarfs everything else each week, as I read that book, I started to realize there was a lot of wisdom and intelligence in that book, and that it wasn't just a bunch of goofy made-up stuff that I thought it might be when I went to read it. And through a process of reading, asking questions, and many years of gathering data about it, actually, I gradually felt myself changing. I became somebody who started to believe not only that a possible God existed, but maybe it was more probable than not. And I started to see if that made a difference in my life, and then gradually started to embrace the Christian worldview. And that has actually made a huge difference in my life. Mm. So now I've run the experiment both ways, and I definitely prefer the Christian worldview.
And again, just briefly, how would you say that particular change in your own life has impacted your career, your scientific work and everything?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny when Nick was saying, you know, we bump up against the boundary of theology. I'm reminded of Donald Knuth, when he was visiting, and he's a practicing Christian, a very famous computer scientist. And when he came to speak about theology, he said, when it comes to theology, mind you, everybody in the room thought he was the world expert on computer science. He says, but when it comes to theology, I'm a user, not a developer. we aren't inventing that, right? There's some truth there that we are barely catching a glimpse of. And in my work, the more I learn about how the human mind works and how the human emotion system works and all, I'm just in awe. I'm in awe of how fearfully and wonderfully we are made. And it inspires me. And another key piece of my faith is that all people are of equal worth. And that has driven my willingness to work on topics with people who are often stigmatized for conditions that other people didn't value so much. They didn't value those people so much because they had those conditions, which is a horrible tragedy. And knowing from my faith, this view that we're all of equal worth, I have, you know, spent a lot of time learning from them, and it has just been tremendously productive in terms of just wonderful relationships, wonderful insights, and now pretty much all of our research has gone in really cool new directions because of things we've learned from their different kinds of minds.
It's great to hear that. Such an interesting area. I could spend the whole evening talking about that, but we've got all kinds of areas that we want to cover in today's program. I want to talk about, well, firstly, the future of AI and whether the sci-fi movies have it right. Now, I don't know what you think of this, Nick, but I guess ever since things like 2001: A Space Odyssey, you know, where you've got HAL basically saying, "I can't do that, Dave," and that sort of thing. We've had this fear that technology will one day essentially get a mind of its own and work against us in some way. How broadly optimistic or pessimistic are you about those kinds of foreboding challenges around AI, Nick?
I'd say I'm a fretful optimist. I think it's going to be transformative, and that both very, very good outcomes and very bad outcomes are potentially in the cards. And we have a lot of ignorance as to how these kinds of things play out. We've never seen a transition to a machine intelligence era before. We don't have that much evidence to go on. So some quite large amount of uncertainty seems appropriate in terms of our expectations.
I mean, what are some of the potential challenges or even pitfalls that you anticipated in superintelligence? And I'm aware the book came out a few years ago now. So do you think the landscape has changed a great deal in terms of people's, I suppose, awareness of some of these areas of risk?
It has changed a great deal. I think, well, first, in terms of actual AI capabilities, I think progress has been faster than was generally expected back in, say, 2014 when the book came out. Really exciting developments in deep learning and a lot of things every year. Another way in which the situation has changed is that when I wrote the book, it was partly to draw attention to the need to do research in advance of how to align very powerful AI systems with human intentions, or other ways making them safe and controllable. Back then, it was an extremely neglected area. It was kind of relegated to science fiction authors to just make up fun and interesting stories, like the one about HAL and many, many others. But there was no, like, I mean, you have people being paid to do research on the dung beetle, and there's like a whole community with peer-reviewed articles studying every aspect of the dung beetle's life and physiology, but this didn't seem to qualify. But that has changed in the years that have passed. There is now a vibrant research community working on the alignment problem, and we are in fact doing. We have a group doing that at the Future of Humanity Institute, but at DeepMind, at OpenAI, and at a number of other places, there are now some really smart people working on this.
I mean, do you consider that there is a genuine threat at some point in the future of some kind of, you know, cybernet type situation developing where AI will get to the point where it becomes self-aware and develops its own, you know, attitude towards the world and how things should be run and turns into some kind of cyber dictator? I mean, is that just sci-fi as far as you're concerned, or is it a genuine thing that could happen if we didn't, you know, keep an eye on and you know, moderate the way we develop AI?
Well, it's easy to anthropomorphize AI systems, and that usually blocks understanding. But it is true that if you have very powerful optimization processes where you have some kind of learning mechanism that tries to gradually improve performance against some specified objective, that you often find that the ways in which the system goes about meeting the objective is unexpected and sometimes undesired. And the potential for these kind of unexpected and undesirable way of meeting the nominal specification that we have put in increase the more capable, the more creative, the more intelligent the system becomes. And so if we, like, extrapolate beyond the systems where we are now, where it's easy to go in afterwards and tweak it and change it if we don't like. But if we imagine that one day these might be smarter than humans and therefore extremely capable and maybe extremely powerful, then it does seem that we are faced with a big challenge here to figure out how to actually align a superintelligence, something that is maybe way smarter than we are, and construct it in such a way that it is nevertheless on our side, a kind of extension of our volition. So I'd say that there are really, maybe you could divide it into three categories of ways in which things could go wrong if we're unlucky in this transition. So one is this kind of AI running amok. And the answer to that seems to be this kind of research to do the technical work to figure out how to align powerful AI systems. The second category would be if these AIs become very powerful, they become very powerful tools. And we know, if we just look at the history of technology, that humans have used technologies for all kinds of purposes, some evil. We use a lot of technologies to wage war against each other or to oppress each other. So there is a concern about if we have increasingly powerful tools, what would we do with them to each other? So that, broadly speaking, points in the direction of improving governance institutions and ethics and other practices. And we have a group working on that. And then there's the third category as well, which is quite neglected, which is not just what the AI might do to us or what we might do to each other using AI tools, but what we might do to these digital minds. If you think that at some point they might become moral subjects, if they can become conscious or otherwise maybe have some of the attributes that give rise to moral status, then I think there is a risk that we might mistreat them, and that a great deal of morally undesirable consequences could flow from that.
I'd be really interested in your thoughts on this, Roz. Where do you stand? Nick says he's fretfully optimistic. I love the phrase of the future of AI. What's your? Are you generally an optimist or worried about where things are heading?
Yeah, my worries are maybe different than the ones usually parroted in the science fiction movies, which are designed to be entertaining, right, and cataclysmic. Sure. I think the real worries right now are more that people use AI to amplify the good or bad things they do. And there are people on our planet who don't share this ethic that all people have equal worth. They think they have more worth. And they're goal is to preserve and protect their power first and handle other people's needs second to that. And many of them see an opportunity to use AI to achieve their goals. And when they have a little power or more power than others, they take the AI and amplify that more. And that's a function that could be very hard to restore some equity to. So my bigger worry actually is when very powerful people who don't have others' best interests in mind, or they may say they do, but they don't act that way, they use the technology to consolidate their power. I see AI as not operating on its own. I see it as something we have made, and those things we've made are, we're ontologically superior to that which we make, not to that which we beget, but to that which we make. And that we have to recognize there's somebody paying for that system, and they're getting money from somewhere, and they've got power from some source. And that's where I think we have to keep our eye on the real worries. I think the rest of it is Hollywood entertainment and distraction.
What about Nick's contention that if we were to see an AI that became a moral agent? I mean, you've been developing software and hardware to measure our feelings. What if AI developed feelings of its own?
Yeah, it's not going to have feelings like we do, but we can make it look like, I mean, already can make it look like it has feelings. And people have already done moral attachment to things that aren't AI, right? I don't know how many people, I remember as a 16-year-old, the car I had saved my money to buy and babied and take care of. And then one day I sold it to somebody else, and when it drove away, you know, I was like, tears of this thing. And you treat it like a baby, and people name their things, right? And we did this even before AI.
I'm trying to get the word out here. Anthropomorphize them, as Nick said, yes.
Right. We do that. And we don't want, you know, and there's examples. For example, you take a little toy robot and make it. So, for example, when iRobot first did this doll that was on the market and they took it off called My Real Baby, and it was the first robotic baby doll, they had to have this decision about whether or not the doll would cry and what would make the doll cry. And they did make the doll cry, but they decided that if somebody strung it up by its toes and started abusing it, that they would not make it scream or cry, because that could actually oogle on the sick kind of person who gets a sick delight out of doing that to something that looks like a baby. And even knowing it's not, it still pushes our buttons. It makes us feel as if it is because it looks that way. So we don't want to, you know, we have to recognize people will feel that way. They will see that in things, even with, you know, 10 years ago AI, much less the future, it will continue. And we need to be careful about what we subject people to there. In fact, there's interest in using robots for helping deal with people who have problems with things like sexual abuse or assault or not caring about somebody else's feelings. Could the robot help them get some role playing in a way that doesn't hurt another person?
Yeah. I mean, Nick, interesting to hear Roz say that she doesn't think ultimately a robot or a piece of AI will feel in the same way that we do. I don't know whether you want to clarify that, Roz. Do you think that this idea of a consciousness in the way that we have consciousness, you don't think that's going to be a reality in AI terms?
Well, I won't say it won't ever happen, because we don't know what we don't know, right? We can't say something is 100% impossible because we're often surprised. I can say that with decades of super bright minds working on all different kinds of computation, biological computers, silicon computers, you know, quantum, we do not see something that looks like conscious experience or emotional experience happening. And so we don't see a path to building it. It's not something that's just going to go poof, here it is with this much faster of a machine or this many more transistors or something, right? It's not about the parameters we know.
Okay. Well, what's your take on that, Nick? Do you think there could be a consciousness at some point from an AI?
Yeah. I mean, it's not completely obvious whether current AI systems, say AlphaZero, how sure were we that they are not conscious in whatever sense? Maybe insects are conscious, maybe some small animal. If the capabilities, the learning abilities and so forth, the behavioral repertoire starts to become comparable to animals, where a lot of humans would at least not feel confident that there is not even a glimmer of consciousness, then it seems our confidence that these AI systems do not have similar kind of internal life starts to seem a bit shaky. And certainly as we're moving, you know, over the coming years towards like things that maybe become more mouse-like, let's say, most of us would probably think mice have the ability to experience pain and to suffer, to be hungry and to have other mental states. And combining that with our lack of like a really solid account of necessary and sufficient conditions for conscious experience, it seems like at least the uncertainty would spill over into hypotheses where some of these systems will have some degree of consciousness long before you reach kind of human level capabilities. And certainly I think it is possible in principle to have, say, a digital computational system that would be fully conscious. In fact, I think indistinguishable from the kind of consciousness that we humans have.
You're listening to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. My guests are Rosalind Picard of MIT and Nick Bostrom of Oxford University, discussing AI, God, and the future of humanity. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Briley.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. Special edition of the show today, bringing you our second episode of The Big Conversation, Season 3. Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard joining me to debate AI and whether technology is the key to immortality. And Nick Bostrom has just suggested that one day we will see AI consciousness that is indistinguishable from human consciousness. And that's where I pick up the conversation. How would you know, I suppose, is my question, Nick, because inevitably, you know, we can probably develop fairly soon, and maybe we already are, you know, algorithms and technologies that pass the Turing test where you would talk to it and you wouldn't know you were talking to a computer. But as far as I'm aware, it's still just a set of algorithms. It's ones and zeros. It doesn't mean anything to the machine. How would you ever know? It's a kind of like the zombie problem, isn't it? How would you ever know that you really are talking to a conscious being and not just an incredibly clever set of algorithms?
I mean, you could kind of ask the same when you're talking to like Rosalind or me, how you could know that we really are conscious and are not just like cleverly mimicking the types of behavior that a conscious being would exhibit. And it seems, broadly speaking, we might point to two types of criteria. So one is what functionally are we capable of doing? Like if we can like respond intelligently to your questions and react to your actions and so forth, that would seem to point to the presence of a mind. And I don't think it's really the case that we right now have the ability to pass the Turing test. Well, we have to be careful what we mean by it. There are sort of crummy versions of it that you could pass by means of cheap hacks. So if you have some naive judges who don't know like the real questions to ask, they will all ask the same kind of questions. And like in the limiting case, you could just imagine kind of having hard-coded answers to the most commonly asked questions. And then probably you could trick some people for 2 minutes in an interview quite easily. And you could do a little bit better than that with current kind of big language models and so forth. But like actually doing like a half-hour interrogation with people who know how to kind of probe, that's way beyond current capabilities. But anyway, so those kind of functional capability-related criteria would be one basis. Like another you might try to point to is the internal architecture. Some people might think it's not enough to replicate the input-output functionality of say, a human for it to have the same mental experience. The internal organization would also have to be sufficiently similar. And there, of course, then the question arises at what level of similarity? Is it sufficient if you have, say, implemented yes. in silicon the same kind of computational processes, or do you need some lower level isomorphism as well? Yeah. But you could have both the same computational structure in principle in a digital computer and the same input-output behavior. And I think that would ground a very strong claim to having the same conscious experience.
So why are you more skeptical of all of this, Ros?
Well, there's functional similarity, okay, where something acts like something and where we give it a bunch of specifications and say, if it does these things, then, you know, it jumps over this hoop and we label it something, like we label it consciousness level 0.2 or something. And we can do that anytime. The more specifically we define the functions, the more likely we are to get the computer to be able to succeed at them in a constrained environment. We're very good if we can specify all possible things that it should do or behave or patterns of them within a space of programming the computer to do things like that. I have ideas how to program it so that it will look conscious and, you know, take a list of functions of consciousness and make it look that way. But am I deceived that it actually is? No, it's just looking like it is. And there is a difference. It may not be a functional difference in an interaction. There are times, you know, when you call for help for service on your computer or something, and the person's just going through a list. I'm like, oh my gosh, you're more like a computer than my computer is, yeah, right? Yeah. There are times when we just act according to this set of procedures, but we know that we have more to us than that, right? We know that we can be motivated by love, that we can be motivated by feelings and experiences that transcend these functional approximations that I program. And I know that because I program them. And I also know that if I didn't program them, that machine wouldn't act that way. It doesn't care. It doesn't feel. It doesn't think or know. And when Deep Blue was switched off at the end of its amazing victory, it didn't care.
It sounds almost like there is a theological issue at stake for you here, though, Roz, I wonder. I mean, obviously, as a Christian, you believe humans are made in the image of God. There's a sort of divine spark, if you like. Does that for you kind of cause you to sort of be skeptical that we could somehow recreate that from the ground up? You know, we could from the dust create a soul, because that's ultimately God's prerogative in your view.
Actually, it gives me maybe a little more boldness than that in the other direction. I believe because of belief in the existence of God and, you know, the lines at the end of 1 Corinthians 13, you know, that now we see as through a glass dimly, but then face to face, right? What does that mean? That at some future point, we will see face to face, and not just like a face, but it goes on to say, and then we shall be known even as we are fully known. And that's like, holy cow, we are fully known, right? That tells me that our consciousness may actually be algorithmically specified by someone, that it is fully known. And I know Nick has written about somebody simulating all of this, perhaps. And so what's really cool is that that actually says, St. Paul says there, that we are fully known. Now, we also have a choice of whether or not we choose to be fully known. And that's pretty interesting, too. And if we are fully known by one that we only see like through a glass dimly, then that gives me hope that actually we will someday be able to understand completely how we work, and that then it is a solvable, identifiable problem. So maybe that's not the answer you expect from a Christian.
No, but that's,
that it
that's,
actually,
that's
I'm actually
really
more hopeful than some of my colleagues that it's completely specified.
That's very interesting to hear in that sense. I mean, Nick, I don't know whether this rings any bells with you, but I guess you're kind of agnostic on the God question, but would the development of a sort of some kind of genuine consciousness in AI, would that swing the evidence away from God in the sense that it would show that life can be, if you like, built from the ground up in a kind of materialistic way, and therefore there isn't any need for the sort of the divine spark or anything?
I don't think it would. I mean, it's hard to generalize because there are many different beliefs about God based on a lot of different experiences and evidence and arguments. So maybe some of those would be contradicted by our actually creating a human level system, but that would leave a lot of others. And it's hard to say. There might be many different ladders on which people could climb up to some conviction about there being a higher plane of being and greater than human possibilities. Maybe this would be one of them. So if you could actually bring into existence intellects greater than human intellects, it would kind of show the existence of space above us. If you have, we talked a little bit, Rosalind referred to my some of my ideas about the simulation argument. It can maybe open up the horizon even for somebody who starts out with a very naturalistic picture of the world, that there could be a lot more in heaven and on earth than is kind of dreamt of when we just look around us and take a kind of naive realist interpretation of that.
I was going to say, talk to us about this simulation, because for those who aren't aware of what we're talking about here, this simulation hypothesis, what is it? And sketch it out for us and some of the implications of it.
So this is an argument which I published back in, I think, 2001 or 2002, that shows that one of three possibilities is true, although it doesn't tell us which one of these. So the first one is that almost all civilizations at our current level of development, if there are many in the universe, like almost all of those go extinct before they reach technological immaturity. So that's possibility one. Kind of be sad if that were true, but it could be. Maybe we all invent some dangerous technology that destroy. Okay, so the second possibility is that out of the civilizations that do reach technological maturity, there's a very strong convergence in that they virtually all decide not to use their immense computational resources to creating simulations, ancestor simulations, simulations of people like their forebears, simulations that would be conscious. And we can discuss that. But the third possibility is the simulation hypothesis, which is that we are living in a computer simulation. Not in a metaphorical sense that the kind of laws of physics were usefully described like in terms of algorithms, but in the literal sense that we are inside some computer built by some advanced civilization. And so the simulation argument then, it involves some probability theory and stuff, but it seems to show that at least one of these three possibilities is true. If we have, I mean, it probably take like another 5 minutes or something like that. So depending on whether you want to, it tends to derail the conversation if you start to pull on it.
That's fine. What I was going to ask was, let's suppose that option three is a genuine possibility. How would that make you feel personally, Nick, if that were true, that all of this that we're experiencing is a simulation, either just in your mind or that we've all got individual consciousnesses that have been simulated? I feel like, a bit like we'd be in the Matrix or something like that. You know, everything we thought was reality is in fact an illusion, as real as it looks to us. For me, it's a very unsettling idea in a way. But what's your response to it, Nick?
Well, I mean, it depends very much on what kind of simulation this was. You could imagine very good ones and very bad ones and all kinds of things in between. I don't think it would necessarily follow, though, that all our beliefs about ordinary reality, like the appearances of furniture around, that would be an illusion, exactly. I think those things would still exist. It's just that the nature of their existence would be somewhat different than we had assumed. But it would be, I think, a more natural interpretation to say that we were a little bit confused about some important questions in ontology, but that our everyday beliefs, they still track information structure around us. They're still useful for guiding our actions. They're still our best basis for planning what to do next, is to look at these patterns we see, whether they're in the simulation or in basement level physical reality, extrapolate from those, build models, etc. So I don't think if we are in a simulation, then we might just as well go crazy and anything is equally likely to work as anything else. I think it would have some more subtle implications, perhaps, for what we could expect in the future and what would make sense to do. But that would require a little bit more kind of work to unearth.
Yeah. Roz, what are your thoughts? Because this is the kind of fairly mind-blowing hypothesis, isn't it? What's your thoughts on it?
Well, I used to build simulations, so I've thought a lot about them. And I'm curious, you know, behind the simulation, there's usually a purpose for the simulation. There's usually some mind, at least in my experience, building the simulation. If it's one I built, it doesn't work perfectly, or the computers don't work perfectly. So after, so many days of simulating or weeks of simulating, some of the computers I'm running it on crash and I have to restart it. And so within the simulation, there's a different time concept than outside of the simulation, right? Depending when you restart and what you reset. There's a lot of attributes of it. And I'm curious, maybe to hear your thoughts on the mind behind a simulation that we could be in.
So I think
what kind of mind do you think that suggests?
So it would be some kind of superintelligence, presumably, because creating simulations with conscious beings and where the virtual environment is indistinguishable from reality is very hard. Like, clearly, it's not something we can currently do. Although computer games are getting better each year in terms of their graphics, but we're still a long way away from that. So I'm imagining that by the time that becomes possible, other things will also have become possible, such as cognitive enhancement of biological intelligence and presumably machine superintelligence. Even if some simulations were done before you had true machine superintelligence, which I doubt, nevertheless, after you have superintelligence, you would be able to build vastly more of these simulations, because with superintelligence, you could like just move much more quickly to the limits, the technological limits that physics permit. You could colonize the universe, turn planets into supercomputers, and so forth. So I think almost all simulations would be built by superintelligences. So that's one thing we can infer. Regarding their motivations, we could imagine a range of different possible motivations for creating simulations. And I think we are somewhat ignorant as to the relative preponderance of these different possible motivations. I mean, you could ask just why do humans create simulations and imaginary worlds? And we do it for all kinds of reasons. There's like recreational attempts, right, with video games or movies and theater and so forth. There are maybe like you could imagine historical research, like to kind of explore counterfactuals for history. You could imagine historical tourism if you want to experience the past, but time travel just doesn't work, right, because of physics. Then the second best thing might be to create a kind of recreation of some historical epoch, and then you could kind of inhabit that for some period of time. So like we humans do similar things, like historical reenactments is our best effort. If we could make them more realistic, some people probably would. And yeah, there's a bunch of other things as well that you could imagine, like maybe you could use them for to find out more about the origin or the forces shaping different kinds of AI civilizations, to study how they might have arisen.
It's hard talking online, but one of my colleagues once said he thought maybe that this world and this life was kind of like a simulation, but it was real, but it was one of many, a series of them, and a series of realities. And we were in this one to have the freedom to make the choice as to whether or not we wanted to go on to the next one. And he was a Christian, believing the next one was the great beyond, that if you choose to be known by God, you get to go to. And that was, saying that God doesn't want to force that choice on us. Mm-hmm. This is the world where we get to choose freely, whether we accept this free gift of Jesus to accept this loving gift to go to the next one. Because we come into this world without that choice, right? We're here. We weren't given that opportunity to say, I want to be here. But we get the opportunity to say if we want to go to the next one. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's another class of possible reasons for why somebody might create these things. And you could imagine kind of people wanting a second run, you could imagine, yeah, all kinds of reasons. Like maybe if somebody died early, you could imagine creating a simulation where they are allowed to continue out their normal life, and then maybe after that migrate into this larger reality. Like it's easy to create a lot of different imaginary possibilities. What's harder to do is to find some way to kind of constrain them and form a very firm expectation for. Because ultimately, it's a question of numbers here. Like, what would most simulations be like? Like, if the universe is sufficiently big with a lot of civilizations, probably all of these and many other reasons have actuated some creation of simulation somewhere. But we would be most likely to be in the most common type of simulation. So if we are trying to form some kind of prediction about our own position.
It raises the whole question, though. It does raise the question for me, though, Nick, as Rosalind sort of alluded to, of the purpose of doing this, because it almost feels like such a super intelligence that could simulate an entire universe and our consciousness within it is almost godlike as far as we're concerned, you know. And when I hear people like Elon Musk and others sort of taking this idea quite seriously, that we are simply living in a sort of supercomputer simulation, I kind of almost wonder, isn't sort of the traditional God hypothesis that there's a transcendent divine mind behind the universe a kind of more parsimonious potentially explanation than this idea of a super intelligent alien race or whatever that has created us, which would itself in a sense need an explanation and just knock the question one place back. What's your view on all of that, Nick?
They're not mutually exclusive. they could both be true, or one or the other could be true, or neither. But they don't seem to have any obviously very strong evidential relationship to one another. So you could imagine a universe created by God, and then in that universe it turns out to be possible to build really powerful computers, and some of those get used to create these simulations. I'm not sure that I would say it's not parsimonious. It's not really a postulate brought in order to motivate something else. It's in that respect, I think, I mean, it's, there are these arguments in the history of philosophy that form the basis of a skeptical challenge, like how can we know that the external world exists, that we are not dreaming, or that it's not all just an illusion. So these go back, I mean, to Descartes, and you can find earlier ancient examples of this. But there, the structure is that you kind of start from a position of doubt, and then the challenge is prove to me that the external world exists. And then there's philosophy around that. But here, rather, we start by assuming that everything is as it appears to be. You know, there are trees and trains, and there are computers, and there are scientists improving the computers, and we can study the laws of physics. They seem to suggest you could build much more powerful computers with more advanced technology. And you kind of think through the implications of just taking all of this at face value. And one of those implications seems to be that at some point in the future, you could build extremely powerful computers, and you would have the other prerequisites required for creating simulations with gazillions of beings with experiences like ours in them. Many, many more beings than have existed through human history. And then you ask, if that is the case, if the world is such that there were all of these many, many orders of magnitude more beings with our experiences in computers than in original history, then where would we most likely be, given that from the inside you couldn't tell the difference? Then appeal to a kind of piece of probabilistic methodology known as anthropics, where it seems like in that kind of situation you should apply a kind of principle of indifference. And so it would follow then from that with overwhelming probability we would be in the simulation. So there's no kind of extraneous assumption you have to make in order for that reasoning to go through, it seems. There certainly are assumptions, but they are not kind of extraneous. I mean, obviously we're assuming here some form of substrate independence, that in principle you could implement consciousness on other substrates than biological brains, like for example on silicon computers. So that's kind imported from philosophy of mind.
And is that where you... I mean, again, I'm detecting a kind of a level of that you're more skeptical about all of this, Roz. And is it because of, again, that consciousness
issue? Well, it's speculation. Where's the data? Where's the evidence of this, right? You're a philosopher, I guess, and a white male. You get away with a lot of speculation. I have to have data.
There's plenty of data. Like, in terms of what kind of computational performance does the physics that we have in our universe permit. And so you could do a theoretical model, say, of various nanomechanical systems where you can estimate, not exactly, but you can sort of estimate a lower bound.
I've built statistical physics models. Yeah, no, I know. I've built statistical physics models. I did my doctorate on statistical physics models, simulating, you know, with probability greater than zero, the space of everything that we were trying to create, and visual images in the beginning. So, you know, map the whole world visually. So I know the math, and I also know that it's different than feelings, experience, and consciousness. We can represent it. We can symbolically represent it. We can map it, and we can build gorgeous math, which we also don't know where that comes from. Where does all the beauty of the abstract math come from? I'm curious, too, if the mind that you have behind this, if you've thought about how that mind has chosen to create beauty and the aesthetics and the gorgeousness inside, you know, very fabulously abstract math, because I haven't seen you talk about those things, too. One more thing, too, in this simulated world that I think is really interesting is some people have trouble with the concept of miracles in religion. And yet all of that becomes just a snap to explain when you have the ideas you're putting forth with the simulation. In fact, I remember talking to Will Wright, a creator of the Sims games, and, you know, he controls, right? He can change something in the game. And if we're all just in that game world and the creator reaches in and changes something and it violates all the models we've built within that world of how things work, we might say, you know, that can't happen. That doesn't fit our physics. That doesn't fit our graphical world models. But it is possible in the larger world, right, when the simulator reaches in. So I like the idea of the superintelligence out there able to change things in our world. But I think we should be asking, what is the evidence? And I think there is evidence for the God of the Bible. And I'm not sure there's anywhere near as much evidence for some other something out there that's a superintelligence. I'm not saying it can't exist. I'm just asking about real evidence that you could produce.
Yeah, I mean, so you kind of cut off.
You obviously feel it's a bit of an extravagance, Roz, but go on, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to kind of follow along the argument and see where the assumptions come in. And those are the bits that would require evidence, if any. But it sounded like the part of it that you were objecting to was not so much the ones that one would normally think would require evidence, but rather the substrate independence thesis, like the assumption that, say, these digital minds that could be simulated on digital computers, that they would be able to have all the kinds of experiences that we have, conscious experiences, including experiences of love and what other favorite emotions that we might point to. So that, I think, is more a philosophical assumption than an empirical one. And I, for the purposes of the simulation argument, like the actual paper doesn't try to defend that at all. It just says this is a common assumption amongst, in philosophy of mind and computer science. But if I want to dive into that discussion, then, I mean, I could look at kind of, say, some of the more popular or more well-motivated theories of consciousness that we have and see whether they... what they imply about the possibility of instantiating conscious states in computers. So we could look at the, say, global workspace theory or attention schema theory or higher order thought theory. So it seems like a lot of these currently like most favored theories of consciousness, although by no means all, would imply that a digital implementation would be possible.
Yeah, I just think it's important to keep asking for the evidence and for a distinction between representation and reality. And our reality allows us to do very powerful representations and hypotheticals and simulations and speculations, and all of that's wonderful. And I just think it sometimes your statements, it's hard to tell when you're speculating, which I think is a lot of the time, which is fine and wonderful. And when you're talking about facts, they sometimes come across the same way. But it's really important in today's world, especially with all the fake news and the power of it, that we help people who aren't experts on this to think about what has a lot of evidence for it and what is really just a whole lot of speculation. Interesting speculation.
You're listening to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, discussing AI and the future of humanity. And we'll return to our conversation between my special guests, Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard, very shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well,
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable and our big conversation episode between Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard. Before we get back into that dialogue, coming up later on this evening here on Premier Christian Radio and on its own podcast, The Profile, this week Peter Lynas, the UK director of the Evangelical Alliance, is talking to Sam Hales about his life and faith. And Peter's been on Unbelievable in the past as well. I'm sure you'll find that a really interesting edition of The Profile. Next week on the show, can the Bible make sense of modern life, we're asking. I'm going to be joined by Tom Holland and Andrew Ollerton for a conversation on Andrew's new book, The Bible, A Story That Makes Sense of Life. They'll be talking about why the Bible has provided an enduring narrative that sustained many generations that have gone before, and whether it can continue to do so in the future in our post-Christian world. And ahead of his own appearance at the Unbelievable Conference, Tom Holland's going to be sharing, I think very honestly, about his own changing attitudes towards the Bible and Christianity in the last couple of years, especially since writing his magnum opus, Dominion. So look out for that. That'll be a great precursor conversation again to this year's Unbelievable Conference as well, where Tom Holland will be talking about why he changed his mind about Christianity and engaging in, I think, a really sparkling dialogue with N.T. Wright as part of the conference. Unbelievable.live to book your place for Saturday the 15th of May. And just a reminder also that we've got a special curtain raiser that we've just announced just 2 days ahead of the conference, which will be our third episode of The Big Conversation, a live stream episode where you can join us live on Thursday the 13th of May. It's going to be at 8 p.m. in the evening UK time. That's about 3 p.m. in the afternoon if you're on the east coast of the US, or 12 noon on the west coast, but it'll be available wherever you are in the world afterwards as well, of course. And really looking forward to a great conversation on how do we live in a post-Christian world. Identity, myth and miracles will be our subject, so look out for details about that at thebigconversation.show. We've got a show page there where you can register your interest. Make sure you get the link for that conversation. And still to come, Tom Wright will be sitting down with me to talk about the upcoming conference and his conversation with Douglas Murray. So listen out for that at the end of this week's edition of the show. Plus, some of your feedback and the survey results from the first edition of The Big Conversation in this season. That was Alex O'Connor and Bishop Robert Barron debating atheism and Christianity. You'll find out what those who took part in the survey made of their conversation. Right now, though, back to our conversation on AI and the future of humanity with Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard. And do check out our survey for this week's show. We want to know what you think of today's conversation. You can find the link with today's podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Let's talk about another interesting sort of religious perspective on this. Obviously, most world religions have an interest in the idea of immortality, of a life beyond this one. But there's a sense in which AI, in some views, you know, is potentially able to offer us that in the here and now, the transhumanist project, and we can sort of define what that is. But just yourself, Nick, I mean, I read a really fascinating, it is a few years old now, but a fascinating profile of you in The New Yorker, where it talked about the fact that you, I think you're signed up for a sort of cryogenics thing, where when you die, if the technology enables it in the future, you could be thawed out and brought back to life. Do you have a sort of desire, even personally yourself, for kind of continuing to live a sort of an immortality in that sense?
Well, immortality, like that's a very long time, right? So, that's a really long time. I think people jump very quickly from if you would live to more than 80 years, then you want to be mortal. But there's like a lot of space in between 80 and infinite. So, I have no idea. I mean, in truth, I think it would mainly depend on the conditions. And then presumably I would not want to decide once and for all, but take a little bit at a time and see how it goes. And then maybe be in a more informed position to figure out whether you would want another 10 years at that point when you can kind of see what it's like.
But would you like, but I mean, I'd be fascinated to know, is that still an ongoing thing that you'd like to be able to come back in the future if the cryogenics and the technology allowed?
Well, I think most people signed up for this cryonic stuff, like the first best thing they would wish for, I think, would not be to get sick or to be run over by a car in the first place. And this would be a kind of desperate last resort that may not work, but has maybe a greater chance than if you're cremated or something like that, of this worldly reanimation. So I guess there are different questions one could ask. Well, like one is the probability of this actually working large enough to be worth whatever the costs are? I mean, that's like a financial cost, and like there's, I guess, a social awkwardness cost or whatever else. And certainly there are many steps where it could fail, even if you think that theoretically with arbitrarily advanced technology you could do it. Like, I mean, the other things, like what you could die in the wrong way, like lost at sea or something, right? Or maybe the Chronix company would go bust, or there's a big revolution that, I mean, there are many things that could, the future might not be interested in reanimate. So one question is, like, is the probability high enough that it just worth the hassle and the cost? And then the question of the desirability, which is kind of separate from that, which I think obviously would depend hugely on the circumstances.
Sure. Well, given all that, obviously there's a lot of question marks over whether we would want to be awoken in the future, and whether the world is a place we'd want to continue living in. But I guess the interesting thing for me is that AI also holds out the possibility, but again, the question is this just sci-fi or is this sci-fact, of, you know, digitally uploading our consciousness, you know, to the memory banks of some cloud, whereby we could potentially live forever. I mean, it's been explored a great deal recently in shows like Black Mirror and others, where they've imagined this possibility of people effectively, when their physical bodies wear out, they simply go to a sort of digital nirvana. I mean, and in that sense, it's interesting, isn't it, that it's almost as though AI technology is almost taking the place of religion in that sense, in kind of fulfilling the promises that have traditionally been seen as those of faith, of a kind of future life, a life everlasting and so on. Well, I mean, is that... What's behind that drive, do you think, Nick, for people to want to kind of be able to sort of live forever in a sort of digital space in that kind of way?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think there is like some mundane level of motivation. Like most of us just put on a seatbelt because we don't want to die or get injured in a car crash, and you know, we avoid the most unhealthy food because we think we might get cancer. And like, there's the kind of commonsensical desire that most people have, if assuming their lives are sort of reasonably okay, to prefer to live and be healthy. And so for some people, I think it's just like an extrapolation of that maybe they see this is like a possible additional means by which you could increase the amount of expected future life that you have in this life, in this world. And then it's a cost benefit thing. Like, so depending on whatever, how rich they are, maybe if it's a very small fraction of their income that would have to go to pay the life insurance premium every month, and they would rather give up a cappuccino every day and have this, that then gives them X percent chance. I'm sure that for some people, that might be a more complicated or idiosyncratic psychological thing where they need some, maybe they are not religious and they still have a psychological need for some straw to cling onto that could give them hope. I don't want to speculate as to the kind of deep psychological roots for all of these people. I mean, the most striking thing, if anything, is maybe just how few people are. I mean, it's this Chronix thing has been around for many decades now, right? And it's still very much a niche. It's growing, but it's like a very slow linear rate. And you'd think that we just see, like, the state of technology is becoming more advanced. A lot of these other ideas that were really out on the fringes 20, 30 years ago are now kind of like great advances in AI, nanotech, synthetic biology, VR, like all of these things now seem like, oh yeah, we are making progress. A lot of people think, yeah, maybe even this stuff about the simulation, right? That's become quite mainstream. Like a lot of people are tweeting and blogging. Elon Musk is tweeting. And but for some reason, cryonics still remains this kind of just as much a niche thing today as it did back in the 90s. That maybe is more the thing that's
interesting.
Strikes me as needing explanation.
Yeah. What do you think, Roz, about this idea of a sort of, you know, could AI technology be the future to a form of immortality? Again, I guess there's a lot of speculation there, but a lot of sci-fi dramas do hang on this idea that you could, in principle, upload one's consciousness into some digital format, which again is something if it's happening, it's a long way off, and there's the question of whether it could happen at all anyway. But what's your, I'd be interested in your general thoughts on this whole concept.
Yeah, there could in the future be, you know, deepfake synthetic versions of each of us having this talk right now, and then also taking every other digital form of talks or typing, all of our Google takeout, everything we've searched for, texted, or written an email to somebody on, that can be recomposited into a synthetic being that plays as an agent with somebody you could talk to. We've already been doing this in the MIT Media Lab. You know, you build a little agent that's for the deceased professor and ask what that one would have thought, right? Actually, one is a Marvin Minsky bot, and he's one of the ones who also signed up for cryogenics, and that hasn't resurrected him yet, but we can resurrect some of what he said online with a digital form. And it's a kind of immortality, right? I find it interesting, though, that we... so many people I know who aren't, who haven't thought that much about God or what they believe in the afterlife still desire it. It's almost like we're made for it, right? Like, that, you know, some people say, you know, you're hungry because you're made to eat food. You're thirsty. You're made to drink. Maybe we are, there's something in us that is immortal, that desires immortality. Seneca saying, the Greek philosopher saying, we are like mortals in what we fear and like immortals in what we desire. We seem to have something in us that seeks that beyond. At the same time, I don't think a lot of us have thought about it that deeply, what we do in that beyond. And there is a worry, you know, if you have an infinite number of grandchildren, you know, how are you going to attend all those birthday parties, right? You know, there are some practical elements that are, that we don't understand. We don't know how we're going to deal with. But yeah, there's this almost universal desire for it.
Yes. Does the concept, Nick, of everyone choosing at some point to live in, you know, to just keep living, whether it be in physical bodies by that time, you know, maybe the technology is there that you can implant your consciousness into a robot and we can continue living in the physical world. Or it's otherwise in some kind of digital space where, you know, we can create our own reality and have a lovely ever after. I mean, again, it's a subjective question, but is that a good thing as far as you're concerned? Or do you worry at the idea of sort of just carrying on and on and on because technology allows us to?
I don't know exactly how long would be the optimal lifespan. I think it certainly would seem to depend a lot on the conditions. Like, so first of all, I think our intuitions about the desirability of longer than usual lives are shaped very heavily by the fact that in this world, older age is associated with worse health. Right, so you never really get people much above 100 who are in perfect mental condition and fully productive and run marathons and stuff like it. So we just see this very strong association that at a certain point we just fall apart, and it's kind of sad. And you certainly don't want to just extrapolate that and then think we want 100 more years where you're sort of kept alive on some respirator.
Sure.
And like the whole medical team is kind of. That seems utterly pointless. So we have to, first of all, exert the mental push to imagine a different condition where you would actually, maybe you would get stronger every year and healthier and learn more and get new capabilities. And that already seems to quite radically change the aspect of this scenario. I mean, it's kind of sad, I think, that we start early in life at our peak and then at a certain point we go down. Like, if anything, one would maybe think you would want to start at the bottom and then go up. But anyway, so that would be one variable. And then, of course, the world we live in and what other people might also be there. Like, another thing is you think, if I lived longer, but everybody I cared about, my friends and family, they were all dying off. To a lot of people, that doesn't seem very appealing because they imagine themselves be lonely and so forth. But in a scenario where many together could do this, continue the adventure, then maybe that flips. Maybe you don't, if everybody else has got to go on and continue the adventure, you would feel, I don't want to lose out. Like if everybody else, if the party is still going, you get the FOMO effect, right? So without like adding a lot of these specifications, it's hard to evaluate it positively or negatively. And then I would say on top of that, though, like if we consider really radically long, even long finite lifespans, like a million years or something like that, let alone infinite, then I think it becomes even harder because those are just so far beyond what we are normally assuming when we are thinking about living.
But,
or dying.
But it does sound to me a little bit, Litnik, like you regret the fact that we do live in this sort of physical body which does wear out. You it sounds like if there was a way of stopping that, you would welcome it. You don't want life to wear out. You don't, I mean, want,
so certainly
to,
if there were like an anti, like a pill that postponed the aging, I'd be happy. Like, I mean, and people try, right, with creams and everything, like snail extracts from Korea, like every possible means, right? That if there were ways of not just preventing it from showing up, but of actually preventing the cellular degradation, I'm sure once that technology exists, it will be extremely popular, even amongst those people who now kind of dismiss it as saying, oh, that's this kind of hubristic thing we wouldn't want to have anything to do with. It's easy to say when no anti-aging medicine actually exists, but once it's there, like, do you want to have worse knees year by year and like an aching hip, or would you want to have a good hip and good knees and like a good heart and all your neurons still there? Like, I mean, it seems like an easy choice.
It's a fascinating question because at one level, Roz, that's kind of what you're involved in. You're involved in helping people live happier, healthier, longer lives, mm-hmm, with AI, with the technology you've developed. But where does this line exist between what's healthy and what's not healthy when it comes to, you know, encouraging some huge long lifespan, which seems so out of keeping with our normal human condition in that sense?
It's a great question. We had a big effort at the MIT Media Lab years ago called Human 2.0. And it had a physical component with Hugh Herr and his biomechatronics, you know, replacing limbs and giving. This one woman walked in and her legs were so amazing. I'm like, wow, look at, I'm a happily married heterosexual woman and I'm admiring this other woman's legs. And it turned out they were artificial and they were gorgeous. Wow. And she said, I don't know why people say I don't have any legs. I have six pair, you know. And she had legs that could do all these different amazing things. I mean, she clearly, and Hugh can climb rocks brilliantly and even better with some of the different legs he's built. So we know we can physically augment in amazing ways that, you know, could maybe make it so that I don't need to take a car or train from Boston to New York. I could walk and burn off and justify eating more delicious, fattening things without getting fat. So there are all kinds of ways we could augment ourselves. But we were also looking, in my case, at the cognitive affective augmentation. We have a lot of efforts in our lab on that. Could we augment our memory? Could we augment our emotion regulation? Could we help people on the autism spectrum who have difficulty interpreting emotional signals, especially in real time? You know, maybe they're concentrating hard to understand your words and they can't read the ocean waves, 10,000 other patterns of things changing on your face, the complexity of which in a two-way conversation quickly dwarfs not just the moves in chess, but the moves in go for all the possible combinations. It grows so fast. It's so hard for a person to comprehend it and for a computer to comprehend it. And we learn about it, we realize how incredibly complicated all this stuff is and how little we really understand it and how hard it is to help people today, much less augment ourselves in the future. But we think it's a really worthy goal for AI. And the more people maybe who work on those, call them more AI for good causes, you know, to help augment and expand human abilities, maybe the fewer people will work on the AI for bad causes that just make the rich richer and the and exert more control over people and don't treat them with justice.
I guess the question that hangs over it all is, would we want, what kind of a world are we wanting to live forever in as well? And indeed, I suppose, as a Christian, do you see that kind of desire to live on, to potentially kind of live forever and that sort of thing? Is that something that could happen, and would you welcome that? Or is that actually just an echo, as you've said, of an ultimate desire that you think can only really be fulfilled, you know, in God, in a kind of a new creation as a Christian would see it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, personally, I don't desire to live an infinite life. I do desire, however, to get to the next one, the one where I can see God face to face. I mean, what a mind-blowing idea, you know? I don't know 100% that that's true, and my guess is that we very imperfectly understand what has been revealed through the Bible. So probably we have a bunch of it wrong because we just see through a glass darkly. But we are held out this possibility that there is a life beyond this, where we are loved, or we are known, where we can know the supermind, the true superintelligence beyond all space and time. And to me, the opportunity to meet that superintelligence is so exciting that even if it's just for a moment, I would like to see about getting there. I do find myself desiring that, and I think that's consistent with what I read, you know, and learn from a Christian worldview.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like the closest thing, Nick, that you believe to in God in terms of is potentially a superintelligence that we are the creation of, albeit not the same one that Roz has in mind. Would you like, if it is the case that we're living in some kind of, you know, simulation, would you like to be able to meet that superintelligence one day? Would that be a goal that you aspire to?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure whether that's the closest in my belief space either to what Rosalind was talking about. I do fundamentally feel, though, that inadequate to try to actually form a firm opinion about a lot of these things. And I don't really mean this modestly either. It's not as if I think a lot of other people out there are like so much more qualified than me either. I think we're all like these little creatures who are like in a vast world that we understand very little of, and until very recently understood even less. So presumably, even if we're just allowed with our own small brains to continue for another few hundred years, we'll probably figure out some pretty cool stuff. And then beyond that, there are presumably many, many more things that we have no chance of figuring out with our little brains. So it seems likely that we've overlooked at least one crucial consideration, like something, some argument or idea or insight or fact that if only we became aware of it and took it properly into account, would kind of radically change our whole picture of what we should be doing, our whole stack of priorities. Like, it seems kind of a little implausible that we've now found the last crucial consideration and we've got it figured.
And by that, do you mean that you're not prepared to be as certain in that sense that there's a God that will answer all these questions? You think that there's, I mean, I was fascinated, and maybe that we can start to just wrap it up here, but there's a paragraph on your website, Nick, where it says is almost exactly what you just said, which is, in terms of directing our efforts as a civilization, it would seem useful to have some notion of which direction is up and which is down, what we should promote and what we should discourage. I believe it's likely we're overlooking one or more crucial considerations, ideas or arguments that might plausibly reveal the need for not just some minor course adjustment in our endeavours, but a major change of directional priority. And those seeking to make the world better should therefore take it as important to get to the bottom of these matters, or else to find some way of dealing wisely with our cluelessness if it is inescapable. So, what I mean, I guess it's hard to envision what that course change might be, what that big thing is we might be missing. But are you saying that there's, you think we're only sort of in the foothills of where our understanding of mind and technology and everything, where it could ultimately lead us as human beings? Is that the idea?
Yeah. And I think we know a lot of details, but there might be some crucial things about how all of these details fit together, the overall picture it's revealed. I mean, just take this simulation argument. Like, suppose for the sake of this discussion that it's actually right, then until that was discovered, that would just be this massive piece of information about the world that we were oblivious to up until just 2 decades ago. And why think that would be the last such thing? And theology could be one source of these. There might be many other places as well where these kind of earthquakes in our worldview could arise from. But I don't think we've seen the last. And so one feels a kind of ultimate sense of dependency of like hoping that things works out. A kind of humility.
A sense of humility in a sense as well. It's been such a good discussion. Any final thoughts as we start to wrap up this program today, Roz?
Oh, I just wish we could meet in person and continue the conversation. Nick, I have a lot more questions for you probably than the audience wants to hear. Yeah.
Well, ultimately, you know, technology has enabled us in the midst of a pandemic to have this conversation, which is great. So we know that technology certainly serves great purposes very often. All the best as you both go on with your work, trying to make sure that technology continues to serve humanity and not to hinder it. But it's been such a great conversation today. So Nick and Roz, thank you very much for being my guests on The Big Conversation.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks for hosting.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's edition of The Big Conversation. If you'd like to send me your thoughts on email, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always welcome to reach out as well on our social media at UnbelievableJB to follow via Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page for the show. I'm also on Instagram, Justin.Briley, or indeed TikTok, Justin.Briley for both of those. But we would love to know your thoughts about today's show via our survey mechanism as well. And the link for that is with today's show. So do go and fill that in. It's really quick and easy to do that. And we'd love to know sort of what you made of some of the conversation areas on today's show, whether you're a Christian, atheist, or something else. And I'm going to be giving you a sense of what the reaction was in the survey to the last Big Conversation, our first Big Conversation episode in this new season between Alex O'Connor and Bishop Barron in just a moment's time. Just a quick reminder that the Unbelievable Conference is coming up Saturday, the 15th of May. Excitement is mounting, only 3 weeks away now, and we're going to be learning how to tell the greatest story ever told. A wonderful range of guests. We're going to be hearing from N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, Sean and Josh McDowell. We've published all of the topics and seminars as well that we'll be covering in the course of the day. And also worth noting that you can even, you know, if you want to bring a group together, and we've had some requests for this from the US especially, where gatherings are allowed in some form or another, you can email us and we'll do you a special group rate for that kind of a gathering as well. The details are actually over on the website, unbelievable.live. You can email tickets@premier.org.uk. And there's even a functionality where you can delay the conference a bit if you want to start it at a slightly later date. Not able to interact so much in a live sense, if that's the case, if you're time delaying the conference. But of course, we're trying to do this at a time which suits a lot of people to join us. 2 p.m. in the afternoon, UK. And that's about, 9 a.m. East Coast, if you're joining us from the US, or if you're an early bird, 6 a.m. in the morning from the West Coast. It's going to be a wonderful day. Unbelievable.live to book your seat from anywhere in the world. And why don't we talk to Tom right now about what he's expecting from this year's conference and this special conversation we've got lined up with Douglas Murray. I am just so looking forward to, and I know the many people who have booked in so far, Tom, are really looking forward to this unbelievable conference. Particularly the fact that both you and Tom Holland will be speaking and sitting down together to have a conversation.
Right.
Right. What have you heard generally about Tom? I know you've been on my show before to talk to him, but what's been your overall sort of sense of what he's been doing and saying and writing?
I mean, his monumental historical books are fascinating. I haven't read them all. Like, I doubt if he's read all my books, but we try to catch up. And he has this sense of the big picture of certainly Western history, perhaps global history. And in the middle of that, his sense of what Christianity was at the beginning and has become and has gone on being is fascinating from his historical point of view. And it isn't a whitewash. It isn't saying, oh, look, Christianity is marvelous, etc., always has been. There's lots of problems, but he has a strong sense that what Christianity has, as it were, brought to the table in terms of world history is something which hadn't been seen before and has at least the potential, if not always the actuality, to make all the great difference that we all know is needed. And I find that fascinating in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, and I think that has gone alongside, and I think he's been quite open talking about this with me, and in fact he's coming on a future edition of Unbelievable shortly where he talks about this, his own personal journey alongside that, as well as the intellectual journey. There's definitely been an opening up, I think, of the the sense that he has that this begins to make sense at a bigger level for him. But yes, it's interesting and will be, I'm sure, fascinating stuff on the day when we are looking at this theme for the Unbelievable conference, how to tell the greatest story ever told, and unbelievable.live. If you've been listening to this podcast for any time, then you'll already know that that's the place to go to book your place. But Saturday the 15th of May is when it's all happening. And rather excitingly, we've got something of a curtain raiser to the conference just a couple of days before. Thursday the 13th of May, we're doing a live stream conversation between yourself and Douglas Murray, who's a well-known public thinker, associate editor of The Spectator. I think this is the first time you've probably spoken with Douglas Murray. Would that be right, Tom?
That will be the case, yes. I only know him through his journalism, and I haven't read very much of that either. I haven't read any book by him yet. I hope to before then, if there's time. But he's a provocative writer and thinker, and as you will know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, he wrote a piece in The Spectator, which I thought was, from one point of view, fair enough, and from another point of view, missing the point, as it were. And so I wrote a letter to The Spectator, which they published in full, I'm happy to say, engaging with him. Maybe our conversation will take off from there. I don't know.
It may well do. That was the issue of the way the church is handling issues around race and so on. And I thought your response was absolutely super. I saw it shared a great deal actually on my social media. Being printed in the Spectator, yes. I think that may be one issue that comes up. But I think what we're planning to talk about primarily is the idea of identity, myth, miracles, and really whether the Christian narrative that once guided the West has been lost and what it might be replaced with and what we're missing in the process. And what's interesting is when I've spoken to Douglas in the past, he's described himself as a Christian atheist, i.e. he would love it to be true because he sort of understands the need for that kind of a narrative. And it's interesting that I think we're seeing almost in our culture that new atheism becoming rather old hat, actually, and people realizing, what do you replace it? If you get rid of God, what replaces that narrative? Yeah. People can't live in a vacuum in that sense.
Right. And postmodernity has tried to live in a vacuum. And what happens is that trivia, social media, Twitter, but just general play, either play in the sense of doing trivia to pass the time or play in the sense of trying to reinvent the world around yourself, whatever. And these come in to take over, and they can be very, very destructive. And I think politically we've seen that, and certainly personally, and as a pastor, I see that with people.
Yeah, well, we'll be asking the question, do we need, can we live without the Christian narrative, essentially, is what we'll be looking at in that programme. It's going to be a fascinating one. But you can join us on the night, Thursday the 13th of May, via YouTube, via our Facebook pages and so on. Just check the details to make sure you know how to be with us. But very much looking forward to that conversation between yourself and Douglas, Tom. Just a reminder that you can find my regular sit-downs with N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, on the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, now weekly, over at asknt.wright.com. If you enjoy Unbelievable, you'll probably enjoy the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast as well. So two very important dates for your diary. Saturday, the 15th of May, is the conference, unbelievable.live, to book your place. And free to attend, completely free to attend, is the big conversation between Tom Wright and Douglas Murray just 2 days before, on Thursday, the 13th of May. And to make sure that you're in the right place at the right time to watch that on our Facebook and YouTube channel, just register your interest at thebigconversation.show. Get signed up, basically, and we'll send you the links on the day to make sure that you can be with us for that conversation. Good stuff. Why don't we look at some of your feedback to recent shows? We're going a bit long on today's podcast just to squeeze in a bit of this. But I asked you to fill in the survey from today's show on AI and the future of humanity. The first conversation, though, in this current season of The Big Conversation was Alex O'Connor, well-known YouTube atheist, and Bishop Barron, Bishop Robert Barron, a well-known Christian YouTuber as well. And here's what came in on our survey. A lot of people responded to this survey. Thanks to everyone who took the time to do that. One of the questions we asked was, who was most persuasive overall? And the overall response to this was that 52% felt Bishop Barron was, 24% Alex O'Connor, and 20% sort of equally or neither, if you like. So the rest that aren't counted in that percentage were saying they didn't find either persuasive. But 52% in favour of Bishop Barron, 24% Alex, 20% equally. Now, as you might expect, when you break that down for atheists and agnostics answering versus Christians answering, obviously it skews in quite different directions, and the majority of atheists and agnostics answering felt that Alex O'Connor was the more persuasive on the day. But as you can imagine, that reflects in a lot of the way these things break down. Here's another question that got asked. There was a discussion whether God is the ultimate cause of reality, and we asked whether that changed your mind on that subject in any way, their conversation. Well, 65% said they didn't have their mind changed either way. 29% said they felt it made it more plausible that God was the ultimate cause of reality. And 5% said less plausible that God is the ultimate cause of reality. So that was the results on that one. Another question asked whether it changed their minds on the existence of a loving God. Okay. And 60% said it didn't change their mind either way on the existence of a loving God. 24% said it made it more plausible that there was a loving God, and 15% said less plausible that there was a loving God in existence. And another question asked, did it change your mind towards atheism or towards Christianity? 75% reported no change either way. 19% reported that they felt more open to Christianity being true and atheism false. 7% said they felt more open to atheism being true and Christianity false. Now, what's interesting, of course, again, is to see how that divided up in terms of atheists and Christians. So, interestingly, it was 8% of atheists and agnostics who responded who said it made them more open to Christianity, and 17% of atheists and agnostics who said it made them more open to atheism. So it's interesting when you sort of, you know, do the math and, you know, look at the statistics under different headings. Finally, we asked, was it helpful to understand an alternative perspective on faith and belief, the conversation as a whole? And that was very much a resounding yes from all sides. 87% overall said yes. And as I say, that was from really both Christians, atheists, agnostics, and people of other faiths. So thank you very much for taking part in that survey. We've got a different set of questions for you about this week's one. If you can take the time to fill it in, it would really help us to kind of gauge what kind of impact these conversations, these big conversations, are making. Again, you can do that from the link from today's podcast. Thanks to all those who've been getting in touch as well, as ever, with the show. Sorry that we haven't had as much time as usual in the last few weeks to cover some of the many different bits of feedback that are coming in to all of the shows we've been having. I just want to shout out a few people who have got in touch recently. The Exodus Project tweeted us to say, fantastic start to the third season of The Big Conversation between Alex O'Connor and Bishop Robert Barron. Alex was formidable as ever, but the bishop was more than a match, I thought. Thank you for these great conversations every week. And similar enthusiasm from Dom, who gets in such to say, wanted to say thank you for hosting that brilliant conversation between Bishop Barron and Alex O'Connor. I think it was a good model for thoughtful and respectful theological debate. These conversations are so important for people to hear. Stating the case for Christianity through apologetics is a key aspect of bringing people to faith. I don't think it necessarily needs to get people all the way, but if people are able to see that it's at least a reasonable position to have, then I think there's a greater chance of them hearing Christ speak to them through prayer, scripture, the church, etc. Thanks again. As I've said before, your ministry through Premier is of such great value. Dom, really appreciate you getting in touch to let me know that. And there's been a number of other responses to the big conversation between Alex and Bishop Barron. We'll maybe leave some of those for another day. Because last week's show was on Muslims and Christians, Andy Bannister and Archbishop Josiah Iduwufiran. And again, good responses coming into that. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch. Just a couple here. Thoughtfully Catholic tweeted on that whole debate on whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. Is it that, in my opinion, the emphasis in the question should fall more on the word worship than on the word God? Knowing how we worship and why will tell us what or whom it is we think we are worshipping. I thought that was an interesting perspective. Maggie got in touch to say, really appreciate your work. The latest one with Andy and Josiah prompted me to respond. I felt Andy's arguments were easier to follow and made sense, but living in Abu Dhabi, surrounded by Muslims, I felt a bit shocked by his manner of speaking about the Quran, for instance, when he discussed Genesis 15. We would not be respected as Christians if we ever spoke in such a casual way about the Quran. We are also expected to say peace be upon him every time we mention Muhammad. Having lived in Africa, I am aware that Islam is different from country to country, but I feel Andy's manner might well put up a barrier between him and Muslims he's trying to reach, even though he didn't mean any disrespect. Thanks again for your work. That was from Maggie. Thank you very much, Maggie. So just a couple of the sort of perspectives that have come in on that show from last week. And there have been more as well in regard to that Trick of the Mind episode that took place between the TikTok hypnotist Zach Pinsent and Brian Drake, who's a Christian illusionist. Thanks to those who pointed out, by the way, in the podcast, there was a little bit of an audio jumble at one point. Entirely my fault for not producing that show very well. We've subsequently done a better job at the production of that. So if you re-downloaded that program, you wouldn't hear the clash that occurred about 26 minutes in. But there were lots of people saying they found it really helpful and interesting. Phil Stilwell is an atheist who said he found both speakers interesting and articulate. But there's something I said that you wanted to prod, Phil. You said, when I say what would it take for you to believe, it implies that belief is based on some threshold of evidence, right? But rational belief is a degree of belief that maps to the degree of the relevant evidence. Rational belief is intrinsically gradient and does not switch on or off in a binary way. The rational mind is not focused on what to believe, but to what degree it should be believed based on the accompanying confirming or disconfirming evidence. Correct? And two, you say, I've often suggested any actual God wanting an actual relationship with us would speak directly to us. That's Phil has suggested that. I'm very frequently told by Christians it's arrogant to tell God how he would act were he real. In this episode, you say, if there is a God, he would speak to our emotions as well as our intellect. Isn't this also an arrogant assumption to tell God how he must communicate with us? And especially given the clear fact that emotional appeals are used by every religion, you consider false. Why would an actual God use the same tactics employed by those promoting false gods? Well, those are interesting questions to raise, Phil. I mean, yeah, I'd agree with you that essentially, you know, in a sense, rational belief does map onto the degree of relevant evidence. It's just that what we count as evidence may differ quite a lot. So I might find that my subjective awareness of what I believe is God working in my life counts as a piece of evidence that you might not equally think of as evidence, and so on, Phil. So I guess that's one difference between us. In terms of God speaking to us through our emotions as well as our intellect, well, I just do believe that as a Christian. Obviously, other people following other religious paths will claim that they are being spoken to through their emotions as well. And again, that's a subjective thing. I don't see why that means that God, the true God, wouldn't also be doing that, even if other people claim to have heard something and they may be mistaken about it. But yeah, I mean, in a sense, faith in God is different to simply intellectual assent. in other areas of life where we would say we simply rationally believe on the basis of some, you know, specific objective evidence. I don't think it's quite as simple as that. And obviously there was a, you know, quite a lengthy back and forth between Bishop Barron and Alex on that whole subject of the nature of faith and how it should be defined and understood. Jim Cole gets in touch to say, the hypnosis topic was a great show. Thanks for the great ministry. It's had a profound positive effect on my own understanding of the faith. The hypnosis discussion, though, between Zach Prince and Brian Drake was particularly interesting in that it brought up some of the issues with human reasoning that underlie many conversations between believers and unbelievers. For example, they agree that we tend to decide what we want to believe, even if unconsciously, and then search for information to justify that belief. As a result, we end up just restating our presuppositions, but I'm not sure that point was applied consistently. In particular, the implicit assumption seems to be that confirmation bias happens more often in Christianity. Even when it's stated that, of course, this process happens to everyone, including atheists, the conversation then goes along in a matter that basically ignores that statement. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to point out. And yes, I think it's very interesting when you do look at some of the psychological work done in this area. I'm thinking of Jonathan Haidt in particular and The Righteous Mind and others who have talked about the fact that very often, you know, we have a gut, if you like, reaction to what we believe is true. And then we tend to use intellectual arguments to simply justify that particular position. And there is that looming question about whether any of us really believe what we believe purely on the basis of rational arguments. It's rather that we choose what we believe and then defend it with rational arguments. And as you say, that cuts both ways. But I suppose with unbelievable, I've always tried to, I think you have to make your best effort, if you like, to step outside of your own worldview and honestly consider someone else's point of view. And that involves letting down your guard. And we're not always very good at it. I don't claim myself to be very good at it all the time. But I think it's important to make yourself open as you can be, in all honesty, to a different perspective. Great to have these thoughts from you. Thank you very much for all of them. And I look forward to reading out more on future editions of the show. But for now, thanks for being with me on this week's special extended edition of Unbelievable. Don't forget to get yourself booked in Saturday the 15th of May for our Unbelievable conference. It's going to be so exciting. Unbelievable.live is the place for that. And look out for that live stream conversation between N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray. Our third episode of The Big Conversation will be live on Facebook and YouTube, and you can be part of it on Thursday the 13th of May. TheBigConversation.show to make sure you're in the right place at the right time. For now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. Can the Bible make sense of modern life, we'll be asking. Tom Holland and Andrew Ollerton join me for a conversation on Andrew's new book, The Bible, A Story That Makes Sense of Life. They'll talk about why the Bible has provided an enduring narrative that sustained many generations and whether it can do so in the future. And ahead of his appearance at this year's conference, Tom Holland will be sharing very honestly about his own changing attitudes to the Bible and Christianity in the last couple of years since writing his magnum opus, Dominion. Hope you're looking forward to that as much as I am. Come back again next week and be part of the conversation.